Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. Some of the biggest names in science all in one packed podcast. Philosopher A.C. Grayling is in the studio.
This is an example of how an insufficient degree of scientific literacy in the general population comes into play.
We speak to the president of the Royal Society. He's a baron, no less.
Blood transfusions from dogs into other dogs and even into a human. And Samuel Pepys noted that the man who had the blood transfusion was a bit cracked in the head, but otherwise all right after the experience.
They call him Darwin's natural heir. E.O. Wilson tells The Guardian about the Earth's immense and hidden loss of biodiversity.
Right now, we're just fiddling around with efforts here and there, some of them strong and dedicated, but the aggregate of which is not even close to what we need to put things together.
Those science celebs out of the way, we look ahead to the International Year of Biodiversity.
We know if we denude this resource that we have, we will be poorer as a people, not only in terms of the intrinsic value, but poorer economically, poorer in health, poorer in education, in all those ways. So it's in our interest, from a purely selfish point of view, to protect biodiversity.
Plus, who are we?
Us from the outside in, but also from the inside out. The tension between what science tries to tell us we are and what we feel ourselves to be.
A new exhibition looking at identity, covering everything from gender reassignment and time warp twins to the Big Brother diary room. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In the pod today is the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Ian, welcome.
Hello there.
Making it a scientific full house this week also is Robin McKee, the Observer's science editor. Robin, hello.
Hello there. I don't make that a full house. I make that a pair, but never mind. I'm just a poker player.
A pair, but have you two ever been seen in the same place before? I'm just wondering. This is a rare moment.
People have thought we are actually just one person.
This is the entire Guardian Observer science output here, just in one room. It's incredible. This week's special guest is philosopher and author A.C. Grayling. In a series of interviews in the coming weeks, he'll be examining what some of the world's leading scientists feel are the impacts of their work. Anthony, welcome.
Hi.
Now, the subjects that he will be talking about range from climate change to the origin of the universe, life on other planets, to the nature of consciousness. And how could you discuss important issues without also mentioning the most ambitious and expensive science project the world has ever known, the Large Hadron Collider? Now, you're going to speak to five people over the course of these interviews. Tell us who they are and just give us a quick pen portrait of them.
Well, the first person is Ravenda Pachauri, who is the chairman of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Timely.
Very, very timely indeed. And he's a very busy man. I'm lucky to get hold of him. The Copenhagen conference is coming up, of course. And the fourth report that the IPCC did, which he chairs, and by the way, the panel won the Nobel Peace Prize for their work on this, is emphatic that there's now no question but that anthropogenic climate change is a fact. We've got a big problem. Something has to be done. We know that Copenhagen is going to be, well, not the last word on what has to be done. And so we're at a very poised moment here. And my conversation with Pachauri is going to concern that. And the big question about, just exactly what the ethical aspect of all this is. We've got responsibilities to developing countries. We've got responsibilities to the future. How are we going to manage them?
So you're going to be talking specifically, but not about the science of whether this is happening or not. I mean, that's settled, it seems. But the morals of it, essentially.
Well, we are going to talk about the morals of it because that's very important. But we are going to talk about the science, too, because, of course, there's still very, vocal skepticism about the science. In the run-up to Copenhagen, we've seen lots of people, people in this country, people like Nigel Lawson and others, writing in the broadsheet papers saying that let's not spend billions on something that may not be the case. We've got people saying, oh, sunspot activity, look at it, we're in for a mini ice age, it's not going to, things not going to warm up. A lot of skeptical voices out there too, and I think it's very important, especially from the point of view of getting all the constituencies around the world to bring some pressure to bear on their political masters, that people should really understand what the facts are and just how serious the situation is.
Well, we're going to talk a bit about the climate skepticism a bit later, so let's move on from him. But you've also got people like the cosmologist Lawrence Krauss and the CERN scientist Jim Verdi. The nature of these these interviews is to talk about the impacts of their work. Now, cosmology and particle physics are amongst our favourite subjects in this pod, but In terms of impact, what's the sort of area you're covering with them on that?
Well, in the case of Lawrence, Lawrence Krauss has set up this institute at the University of Arizona, State University of Arizona. It's the Institute for the Study of the Origins of the Universe and of Life. So, as you see, not very ambitious. part of the motivation behind it is that in the United States especially, but it's a creeping problem, you've got intelligent design people and creationists and others. You have a very mixed picture out there in the educational domain. So it's very important that there should be high-level, top-quality initiative like this one that Lawrence Krauss has set up to educate the public, as well as doing frontline research on these things, which is what the initiative will be doing. It will also be educating the public. And it's done a very interesting thing, actually, because they've brought together cosmologists, astrobiologists, engineers, and people working in the humanities, people who think about our thinking about the universe and its origins and the significance of the scientific picture about the way the universe and life work. So the idea is to try to explore all the different frontiers of understanding involving those issues.
Yeah. I mean, again, another of your interviewees actually is Seth Shostak, who is a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. And this is the organization that's looking for signs of life out there. And it's a real scientific institute. It's not a bunch of crazy people either. I mean, what drives people like him, do you think, to sort of go and do this work?
Well, you know, it's a really good scientific basis that people have. All the evidence suggests that life is abundant in the universe. Now, we're talking about viral or microbial life. Accumulating evidence, the presence of water everywhere. I mean, the big splash of water on the moon just recently is another peg in the board. But, of course, what SETI is looking for is intelligent life. And the idea of intelligent life is a much narrower band of opportunities for intelligent life to flourish, especially because it needs a long time to evolve, so we would assume.
So he's looking for radio signals.
And he's looking for signals from our galaxy. I mean, it'd be a bit pointless. You know, even the most enthusiastic tourist is not going to get to any other galaxy anytime soon. So looking for signals. And one interesting aspect of this is that they're doing a lot of work on how you recognize signals. There's a lot of new sort of computing software work being done on signal recognition stuff so that we can try and disambiguate this massive noise that is coming at us from the galaxy. So, you know, we'll be talking about that.
And that's something specifically that a lot of scientists at CERN have to do in another way. These sorts of signal processing sort of abilities can be used out in space too, perhaps.
It may very well be, yes. Now, my guest on this one is Tejinder Verdi, who's been the spokesman for the compact muon solenoid experiment. That's one of the two big experiments looking at proton-proton collisions. And he invited me over to CERN. I have to say, it was one of the great days of my life. It really was. It's a most fantastic experiment, this thing. It's certainly, you know, without hyperbole, it's the greatest scientific experiment ever built. No question about it. And the technology that's gone into it over the last 20 years, how it's planned, how all the different countries in the world have come together to do this, and something like 27 countries. It happens, by the way, that I'm also a representative of an organization called the International Humanist and Ethical Union at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, just a couple of miles away from CERN. And the contrast between CERN and the Human Rights Council, you know, is staggering. At CERN, you've got Pakistanis and Indians working side by side, Israelis and Palestinians working side by side, Iranians and Americans, you know, because they're doing something objective and sensible. They're trying to understand the structure of matter. And a couple of miles away, they're all at one another's throats. You know.
You're saying human rights isn't a sensible thing?
Well, the human rights are sensible, but at the Human Rights Council, they do very unsensible things.
Ian?
I was interested that you also spoke to Patricia Churchland, the Canadian neurophilosopher, and her point must have been really interesting for you about the idea of free will being an illusion. And when I've heard this idea, the thing that's bugged me a bit is people tend to extrapolate that to mean if free will is in some sense an illusion, therefore we have no conscious control over our actions. And I was interested in where you stand on this. I mean, what do you think, free will is an illusion?
No, I don't. On that particular point, what one has to distinguish, and this is one of those you know, subtleties that that those of us in philosophy departments like to go in for, but there is a difference between being conscious of having made a choice and having made a choice, really genuinely having made a choice where there was an option that you could have done otherwise. Some of the work seems to suggest that we become conscious of decisions that we make, you know, a fraction of a second after we've made them, after we've pushed a button or something, or begun a movement which ends in a button being pushed. And it's not clear to me that you're only willing freely if you're conscious at the same time as you've made a decision of doing it, because we know that masses of mental computation takes place at a non-conscious level. And in fact, most of it does. And so that doesn't surprise me at all. I think the ethical idea of being responsible for things that you do, of being capable of making choices where there were genuine alternatives, is not only so deeply rooted in our picture of what it is to be a human being, what it is to be a citizen of a moral universe, but it is also indispensable to our explanation of what it is that people do, explanations of human action. If you try to remove that out of the picture, you get a kind of incoherence in thinking about human nature.
I was actually interested in two sort of slightly disparate topics there. One was SETI and the other was climate change. We've been looking for extraterrestrial intelligence now for more than 50 years. We haven't found it. As Enrico Fermi once famously asked, you know, where are they? We haven't found them. Is it possible? I mean, how do you react to the idea that we had the ability to invent technology but not the ability to control technology, and that all civilizations are really, or all planetary civilizations are bound to sort of consume themselves, which takes us, of course, into the issue of climate change. Are we beginning to see the beginning of the end?
It's a very good point there. I mean, of course, there are lots of different options as to why, if there are intelligent beings out there. Of course, it's a moot point whether there are any intelligent beings on this planet with the climate change problem. But, you know, that might be one reason that there is a kind of shelf life to any civilization, and that it does consume itself in the end. That's absolutely right. But there are other options too. It may be that they've looked and they haven't liked what they've seen. That's why they're keeping away from us. Or it may be that, you know, there just aren't any ways. There are physical constraints on communicating across distances, or you know, getting physical objects across distances as great as they are in the universe. It might even be that there are sort of reasons in physics, physical reasons, why it can't be done. So you know, it's a very, very open question. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be looking, because I think when you think about the sheer volume of signals that we're pouring out in all the television programs and radio programs. I mean, you know, the Goon Show by now is just about getting to Vega or something like that. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this.
Okay, well, Anthony, thanks for that for now. The series of interviews called Exchanges at the Frontier will be broadcast on the BBC World Service starting on December the 2nd. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/worldservice.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Last week, we sent the science team away with lots of homework. They're tasked to bring in a clutch of top-level interviews for this week's podcast. Ian, you met one of Britain's nicest scientists this week.
Absolutely. Martin Rees, president of the Royal Society, also Astronomer Royal.
Baron.
Wonderful man. Yeah, full stop.
And tell us what you saw him about. Was it just a chat?
No, the Royal Society is planning and celebrating its 350th anniversary. It's founded in the 1660, and it has a year ahead, looking at all sorts of things it's going to do to celebrate its past, but also sort of look ahead to, you know, what are the big questions in science. They're going to hold a whole series of talks with meetings with some high level scientists to discuss what science should be looking at, and also what the challenges of science are. I mean, I was interested in how scientists and science have changed since the foundation of the society. I mean, if you look at what some of these people were doing in the 1660s, and obviously not a long time later, these were, you know, gents with time on their hands, usually going off and doing things.
We'll jump into that just a sec, but here's Martin Rees giving the Royal Society a report card of its past 350 years.
I think it's astonishing what the transformation has been. Obviously, at the time of the foundation of society, then the new world was just being explored. In the 18th century, we were involved in the expeditions of Captain Cook, etc., to bring back strange animals and plants from the southern hemisphere, etc. And then, of course, in the great transformations of the 20th century in science. And, of course, our world is completely transformed through the application of scientific concepts which could not even be conceived of by our pioneers. The quantum theory, for instance, it's nearly 100 years ago now, is very counterintuitive and could not have been conceived of by people back at the beginning of the society.
As part of this anniversary, you're making some of the key papers from the past 350 years available to the public online. And I was just interested what some of your favourites among those might be. There certainly seem to be some real gems when you look around.
Well, of course, what's remarkable is the variety, and it's especially interesting that for the older papers, of course, we have handwritten manuscripts of them, which, of course, we don't have for the modern papers. It's hard to highlight them, but there was a rather gruesome experiment by Robert Boyle and others where they did a blood transfusion from one dog to another back in 1666. And a bit later than that, there's a paper by Isaac Newton, not on his theory of gravity, but on the nature of white light. He sent the light through a prism, which broke up white light into colours, and then he put it through another prism, which converted back to white light. So he showed clearly that white light was a mixture of all the colours. And I'm especially interested in this because the experiment was done in Trinity College, Cambridge, which is my own college and where he was a fellow for about 30 years. Moving onwards, I'm fascinated by the explorations. I mean, the experiments discoveries of Captain Cook, etc., things they found, and also there's a paper by Captain Cook about how he managed to avoid losing the lives of any of his seamen through scurvy because he got an appropriate diet for them. And on his first voyage, he was accompanied by Joseph Banks, who became the president of the Royal Society for 42 years and was very wealthy. He bankrolled the society over that entire period. But as a young man, he had gone with Captain Cook as a tame biologist on the Endeavour. Modern presidents have neither Joseph Banks' stamina nor his financial resources and served for just 5 years.
And there's also one thing in there that's slightly more modern, Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose's work on black holes, I believe.
That's right. This is a case where theory-led observations, theoretical ideas of black holes developed through the work of Penrose and Hawking in particular in the late 1960s. And we now know pretty well for sure that black holes exist, huge ones in the centres of almost every galaxy. And it's remarkable that these extraordinary predictions of a set of equations discovered by Einstein do actually exist in the universe. And one of my scientific interests is in trying to understand them and the phenomenon they give rise to.
President of the Royal Society and Astronomer Royal Martin Rees there. All these men, these gentlemen you were talking about earlier, who did the science in the 1600s.
Well, the archive is an extraordinary thing. And this was an era where everyone seemed to be a character. And I mean, I wanted to first maybe just touch on something that a chap called Daines Barrington, who is a medic and a scientist, sent in a letter to the Royal Society. That's how all these people communicated. You wrote a letter to the president and saying, this is what I found. It was on the 28th of November in 1769. And at the time there was, Mozart was doing the rounds. But some people were concerned or not sure whether he really was a child genius. So Daines Barrington decided to, first of all, get Mozart over, check out his birth certificate, but also check out his behavior and also his whether the phrase genius was warranted. So he ran a number of tests over a few days. And you know, they say he checked out his birth certificate, but he would give him themes or ideas and say, okay, go and compose something, come back in a couple of days and we'll hear what you've played. And you know, some of the things, and these are all handwritten letters, and one of the bits I'd sort of deciphered from a letter, it said his execution was amazing considering that his little fingers could scarcely reach a fifth on the harpsichord. So this was after a couple of days of giving an idea. He went away and composed something, came back and played it. But then it touches on the evidence at the time that Mozart was indeed a boy and not a small adult. Said, whilst he was playing to me, a favourite cat came in, upon which he immediately left his harpsichord, nor could we bring him back for some considerable time. Later, it says, he would also sometimes run about the room with a stick between his legs by way of horse.
So this proves that he was a boy, and this is what boys do. They run after cats. And
it's interesting to sort of see what was regarded as evidence at the time. I mean, basically, it's observation rather than, you know, anything more substantial than that. And science has certainly, you know, lost a lot of its character in its in how it's been methodized, I suppose, if that's even a word. But there was one other thing I wanted to add, which was Benjamin Franklin, who flew a kite to and investigated electricity and lightning, witnessed the Montgolfier brothers' first hot air balloon trip, and he was very excited about what the possible applications of this might be in the future. He was gobsmacked by seeing the hot air balloon in the first place. And it gives you an insight into the kinds of characters who populated the Royal Society. His idea was that probably men who lived in the country would be able to strap hot air balloons to their errand boys so that as they ran from townhouse to townhouse, they'd be able to hop over the hedges in fields a lot more easily. And another idea he had was maybe you could attach a basket to one of these balloons and put your wine and some of your food in it and loft it up to a decent altitude and thereby becoming the first fridge.
This is what Ben Franklin thought were the first practical uses for hot air balloons.
He had a kind of throwaway idea that you may be able to charge people a guinea to go up in them at fairs, but he didn't think that idea would fly.
Well, you can join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall, of course. You can leave the thoughts on the blog as well at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now, there's so much in this week's show that we don't have time for the news jam. There is one story we want to discuss, though. There's no other word for it. It's that climate change emails hoo-ha. Sometime in recent months, hackers made their way into the email servers of the University of East Anglia, downloaded private correspondence between climate scientists, and posted the whole lot online. For anyone arguing that climate change isn't happening, it seemed like a boon. Selected and unverified extracts from the emails appear to show scientists colluding to manipulate climate data. The university has already said it will launch a review into the incident, but all this couldn't have happened at a more damaging time. In a couple of weeks, leaders will meet in Copenhagen to discuss how the world should deal with climate change. James Randerson, editor of The Guardian's Environment website, is here to discuss some of this. James, welcome.
Hello.
So run us through the quick timeline of this. What happened when and who called for who to resign when?
Actually, weirdly, the story starts about a month ago with a small selection of these emails apparently being sent to a BBC weatherman called Paul Hudson. Those emails were between some of these scientists, and they were apparently referring to a piece that he'd written on the BBC website. Now, he apparently didn't do anything with them, and everything kind of went quiet. And then sometime 2 weeks ago, the emails were uploaded briefly onto the Real Climate website. I think it was on the Tuesday of that week. Real Climate realised that there was something strange going on, took them down and informed University of East Anglia that the emails were there. And then on Friday, they surfaced on a Russian server and eventually ended up on a website called AirVent. So the emails were sort of floating around in the ether before they appeared. And actually, the University of East Anglia knew that this huge train was coming.
But was hoping that it just wouldn't hit them.
Well, exactly, yeah. They seem to have adopted a kind of head-in-the-sand strategy, because on Friday they were clearly not prepared for the press interest in all of this, and just, you know, gave a very brief statement. And then, you know, it took them until Tuesday before there was a fuller statement and an interview which was done by PA with the scientist at the centre of it, Professor Phil Jones.
So the reason that the press were interested, or some parts of the press were interested, is because of what seems like, within the emails, what seems like the scientists talking about hiding data or using tricks to massage data. Now, let's just tackle that first of all. What were the contentious bits, and how did these scientists explain themselves?
There's one email where Phil Jones refers to, quote, a trick that apparently someone else had used in a Nature paper.
And Phil Jones is one of the scientists involved.
That's right. He's head of the climatic research unit at University of East Anglia. And he then says, you know, that he's going to use this trick to, quote, hide the decline. Now, the context of all of that is not that clear from the email, to be honest. But, a lot of people have kind of seized on that, as you can imagine, as some kind of part of this huge global plot to manipulate the evidence to show that climate change is happening. But in that particular case, I think it's fairly clear that this was
a colloquial phrase that doesn't really mean quite what it appears to, because what they're talking about here is marrying together two data sets, the real measurements of temperature, which of course are pretty reliable, and a proxy measurement of temperature, which is tree rings. Now, obviously, going back more than a couple of hundred years, there aren't good temperature measurements, so you have to use other things. And there's a kind of bit where there's an overlap in between. And apparently what they're referring to is there's a strange anomaly in the tree ring data where it appears that there's a decline in temperature, but actually we have the real temperature measurements that show that there isn't. So that's kind of what they were doing. I think they were getting rid of they were stopping the tree ring data at the point where they didn't need to use it anymore.
So the people have seized on this, the skeptics have seized on this as sort of collusion among scientists, as some sort of smoking gun for the fact that climate change, as according to them, isn't happening, or isn't at least man-made. This is just how scientists operate, isn't it? I mean, no one's actually questioning the peer-reviewed work by any of these scientists or the
well, some people are, but I mean, the real difficulty here is that the scientists haven't come out and given clear explanations for what these emails refer to. I mean, I actually don't think that's the most incriminating one. There are other emails where there's apparently, I mean, this is all should be hedged because it's quite difficult to tell exactly what's gone on, but it looks like there's been a Freedom of Information Act request for some emails, and then the scientists have said, okay guys, let's delete all those emails because they don't want those emails to be sent out.
It wasn't quite like that, was it? It was more like, I'd rather delete it than someone said,
that's one email, but there's another email where it just says, you know, I've deleted all my emails to do with this, you should too, or something like that. I mean, it obviously, you know, we refer to the exact text, but it's pretty damning, or it looks like it anyway.
Robin, this is just how scientists work, isn't it? They like, if you looked at any of our emails, it'd be just as bad.
Well, that's it's not just how scientists work; it's how humans work. I'm just thinking of journalists operating, and if we had email exchanges in which there was sort of, you know, there was very sensitive information that perhaps disclosed a source who'd given information for a story, and Her Majesty's police came around and said, give us these emails, what would we do? We would get rid of them. It doesn't mean to say that those emails aren't true and don't express the truth. So because somebody is deleting an email doesn't mean to say they're covering up a lie. They could be more likely to be covering up the truth. I find it's very unfortunate, this. I don't see how it affects Copenhagen, and I don't see how it affects Phil Jones in the slightest.
And Anthony, on that question of climate denial, you mentioned this just earlier as well. I mean, when you're talking to Rajendra Pachauri, I'm sure this will be an issue, but do you think that climate change denial, for some reason, it's different to other types of denial? I mean, what makes people do this, do you think?
Well, a complex set of reasons, but if you look at the individual level and at the government level, at the individual level, you know, climate change is just incredibly inconvenient because it means you've got to change your lifestyle in ways that you don't want to change. In fact, your aspirations are to emit more carbon if you won the lottery or something. And for governments, you know, they're worried about unemployment increasing, they're worried about GDP declining, they're worried about their competitive advantage with other countries if they try and take too much action to be greener. So there are lots of motivations for trying not to take it seriously or trying to put the brakes on a bit or wait for other people to take some action. And the result is, of course, delay and muddle. On the issue you've just been discussing, though, this is an example of how an insufficient degree of scientific literacy in the general population comes into play. Because if you look at something like the recent IPCC report on climate change, the fourth one, it's full of italicized expressions, likely, very likely, high degree of confidence, low degree of confidence, talking about the evidence. Now, the fact is the scientific evidence is complicated, and looking at something as big and as messy and as difficult as climate change and all the evidence and all the indications and trying to marry them all together, trying to make sense of what's happening, there's now, you know, the Stern Report and the IPCC have said it's unequivocal that there is anthropogenic climate change, that there is a serious problem facing us, and it's a health problem. A billion people are going to be affected by rising sea levels. You know, it's a massive problem. And even if it were only half right, it would be, or even only a quarter right, it would be a big motivation to do something because it's going to cause all sorts of chaos. And what does all this relate to? It relates to the fact that there's a 50% probability that the climate's going to increase in, you know, it's going to go up 2 degrees centigrade in warmth by 2050. You know, even that is a probabilistic claim. So, you know, it's a lot of uncertainties, a lot of difficulties, a lot of complexities, out of which a pattern emerges that says we've got to do something. So something like this should be really marginal. I mean, of course there are going to be blips and dips and anomalies and things, but you've got to look at the bigger picture and understand how it works.
Okay, thanks, Anthony. To read more about that story, go to environmentguardian.co.uk. Next up, homework-wise, producer Andy had a rare night out in London.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
I'm outside the magnificent Natural History Museum amid the sparkling lights on the trees and the ice rink that's just been set up outside. I'm about to go inside the main entrance for the launch of the International Year of Biodiversity here in the UK.
Hugh Eranka-Davis, Minister for Marine and Natural Environment.
Is it a hard sell for the public? Do people understand what biodiversity is?
I think we've got to find ways to communicate this in a way that really matters to people. If you look at, for example, people get very excited about iconic species, particularly when they're large species, the great whale, the tigers of this world, or even where I was recently in the Cayman Islands and looking at the blue iguana and how that led to habitat recreation. One species, which needed a fair area to actually roam across, led to extensive environmental change within the Cayman Islands. How do we get that message out about biodiversity, about how it links to climate change agenda, and why it is so important? What we do know is, whether we are talking about future discoveries that may be made that will benefit us, that may benefit not only the pharmaceutical industry, but people who are suffering from diseases, and we find solutions that we haven't even envisaged yet. Or alternatively, it's those minutiae of the intrinsic webs that link species together. We know now how important it is to sustain the real diversity of life for flora and fauna. And I think children get it. I think adults increasingly get in it. International organisations, including ones like the World Bank and others, are getting it. And we need to use this year ahead to actually really celebrate biodiversity, talk about the challenges ahead, because we'll be looking at the post-2010 target, and then drive ahead with a real international consensus. And that's the challenge.
Because, after all, biodiversity is life. Biodiversity is our life. Thank you very much.
I am Ahmed Jouglef, the Executive Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity, that we like to call the Convention on Life on Earth.
What would you like to see come out of Copenhagen?
I think Nicola Stern has issued 2 years ago this fantastic report on the cost of inaction on climate change. We'll be issuing a Stern-like report, the Paben-Schuskev report, very soon on the cost of inaction when it comes to biodiversity. So postponing action, but both on the front of climate change and biodiversity may cost money today, but it will cost more tomorrow. And we are reaching, when it comes to biodiversity, I think, the tipping point. If we don't take action now, I think it will be too late. So I think, I hope in Copenhagen that our leaders will understand that time to act is now, and postponing it to later will not help us, and definitively will make it worse. Addressing climate change is very important, but you cannot achieve it without biodiversity. And if climate change is a problem, and it's a real problem, biodiversity is part of the solution.
For more information on the UN Year of Biodiversity, go to biodiversityislife.net. Now, staying with the theme, for his homework assignment, James Randerson went for a big name across the Atlantic. When it comes to studying biodiversity, they don't get much bigger than this. James, you spoke to one of your heroes.
I did, yeah. It was a great privilege. I've been trying to interview Professor Edward Wilson for well, most of my career as a journalist, to be honest, and finally got the chance, unfortunately, just over the phone, because he was supposed to be coming to speak at an event on Tuesday last week, which was the 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species. He was speaking at supposed to be speaking at this event at the Royal Institution. Unfortunately, he was not able to come, and he delivered his lecture via video link. But we spoke over the phone, and he had a lot to say about the biodiversity crisis that's happening at the moment and the fact that he thinks it's being crowded out somewhat by the attention that global warming is getting.
There's a case to be made for creating an initiative. And I don't know exactly how this would gather more strength and momentum, but there's a powerful case to be made for creating the equivalent of the IPCC for the living environment. That is to define what it is we need to know about the living environment to save it more precisely than has been attempted, and include in this program a much stronger effort to estimate the numbers of species, and then extend the work of IUCN and other world organizations that are trying to explore biodiversity on Earth and protect it, extend their effort into exploratory studies of the nature and the amount of biodiversity and what's happening and the like. I'm just composing a book, an article, which we will, which I hope we will be able to place in a prominent journal, calling for just this effort. The effort we're calling for could be given a name like the Barometer of Life. I believe that that's what the kind of effort that really would result in solid progress in taking better care of the living environment. By that I mean biodiversity.
The great E.O. Wilson there talking to James Randerson. Now, James, you've been celebrating the 150th anniversary of the publication of Darwin's great book in your own way.
Yes, well, this was another great privilege, actually. I went to an event at number 50 Albemarle Street, which is the John Murray Publishing House, where On the Origin of Species was published 150 years ago. It's just off Piccadilly in London's Mayfair. And it was just a fascinating evening because, you know, there was the great-great-grandson of John Murray III, who was Darwin's publisher, and there was also the great-great-grandson of Darwin was there, Randall Keynes. Not only that, but there was also some amazing kind of Darwin artifacts. There was a leaf of the original manuscript with some of Darwin's writing on it. Apparently, Darwin didn't really value the manuscript after he'd written it, and he gave the pages to his children to use as notepaper. And so a lot of them just disappeared, but I think about 40 were discovered in a cupboard a few years back, some of them with scribbles on that the children had written. And you know, apparently that piece of paper is worth over £200,000. There was also the publisher's original file copy of the book. There were only 1,250 published in the first publishing run, so that it was quite a privilege to see all those things.
Anthony,
yeah, it's just that room that James was in Albemarle Street was in the fireplace in that room was where Byron's memoirs were burnt because they were too pornographic.
Yes,
you didn't pick through the ashes, did you, or anything?
Well, I was talking to John Murray's wife, Virginia, and she did look when I sort of said, "Oh, I bet you regret that," and she kind of went, "Yeah." I bet those memoirs would be an interesting read.
Tell you two hang around in much, much more lofty circles than I do. Anyway, A plus for that homework, James. The whole half-hour chat that James has done with E.O. Wilson is available as the latest Science Weekly Extra podcast. Go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Hi, this is Katie Tunstall, and you're listening to Science Weekly on guardian.co.uk.
And finally, plenty for you to live up to. Robin, what have you been up to for your supposed homework?
Yeah, my homework took me to Euston Road in London.
Which, by the way, is just outside the Guardian offices.
Yeah, it was a real long trek, that one, yeah. To the new Welcome Collection exhibition, which is called Identity, Eight Rooms, Nine Lives. And this is an explanation of the concept of identity and what individuality means, explored through sort of seven famous or not notable lives, plus an extra little room that's dedicated to the study of twins. Because the twins, of course, raise all sorts of issues about identity and who you feel you are. But a special case, and it's done very nicely there.
Okay, well, this is co-curator Hugh Aldersley-Williams in the room dedicated to Sir Alec Jeffreys, who he's the man who invented DNA fingerprinting.
DNA is always controversial, and it's always there and a topic for discussion. We've actually gone fairly light on the obvious controversies of DNA record-keeping by the authorities and how long it should be kept for and those sorts of things, although Alec Jeffreys has very definite views about the DNA database and so on.
I mean, you've got some of the more important aspects of his story on display here. One of the first cases in which DNA fingerprinting was used for immigration cases, which has had a profound effect on British immigration law, has it not?
Yes, and it can have, you know, good effects as well as bad effects, so it's not all sinister that DNA records are being used. In this immigration case, a boy went abroad from his British family, came back to Britain, and his the passport legitimacy was challenged, and DNA evidence was used to confirm that he was related to the family he was claiming to be coming back to and wasn't an interloper, as the immigration authorities thought.
And you've also got the front page stories from the Colin Pitchfork murders. And also I see a front page story from the Guardian actually giving first details of DNA fingerprinting.
Yeah, that's a key story because it comes out just the week after Alec's Nature paper came out with the breakthrough described in it. And then it was lawyers reading that story that led to this technology finding its way into society so quickly.
And establishing scientifically, I mean, individuality with a precision that was really not possible before.
Yes, I mean, that's an interesting point because establishing identity for identification purposes by authority, let's say, keeping it as broad as that, is always contentious and it's always a kind of insult. It's a reduction of the complexity of what we are. And so actually I think that whether it's a PIN number or a fingerprint or a photograph in a passport or something as complex and apparently as complete as a DNA profile, it's always a reduction of the person. And therefore it's always going to be seen as a kind of insult by the person to, you know, who it purports to represent.
I'm a name, not a number.
It doesn't really matter what technology you use. I think it's always going to be like that.
Yes.
It's never the complete person. So it's always a contentious issue.
Co-curator of the exhibition, Hugh Aldersley-Williams, there talking to Robin. Robin, what else is sort of in the exhibit that's sort of worth noting?
Well, there's lots of really good. There's a nice one on Sir Francis Galton, who's the polymath cousin of Charles Darwin and the inventor, of course, of eugenics, who studied individual differences and believed that these were sufficient to discriminate against and led to all sorts of horrors, including the Holocaust. My favourite, though, is the Samuel Pepys. There's a small room dedicated to diarists with Samuel Pepys, obviously the most famous diarist in the English language. Interesting fact that I did not know, that his first full edition of his diaries was not published until 1983. Publisher kept bits back because of their sexual explicit nature.
Wow.
So he joins a band of other great people that
Byron,
we've already discussed.
Peeps. They just couldn't keep it in. Ian, you've got a question on this.
Well, my question was probably for Anthony on this whole notion of identity. I mean, there's kind of a temporal aspect of this in that identity isn't a static thing. And so I wondered whether there is even a use in defining words like me and you. I mean, and what criteria do we use to sort of measure those? I mean, what makes me might not be what makes me in 10 years' time.
Yeah, not only that, but you're also a slightly different me in your different relationships with people. I think identity is an extremely complex thing and an evolving thing. It's a dynamic rather than a static thing. And when you do try to label people according to certain identities, then what you do is you fix them in place. You stick a pin through them like a butterfly in a collection. And what's worse is when people assume singular identities. I mean, for example, if you went around in a burqa, you'd be saying one thing about yourself. And that's very diminishing. And it makes a demand of other people to treat you a certain way, which they may not want to do. I mean, they may want to encounter you as a, you know, as a somebody that they might have a relationship with, a friendship or work or colleagueship or something like that. But they want to do that on the basis of your merits as an individual, not in some label that you've stuck on yourself or that somebody else has stuck on you. In fact, a lot of the problems in the world, especially with, you know, problems with immigrant communities in any country, is that other people stick labels on them and think of them in terms of those labels, and that's very destructive of them.
You can see a video of the new exhibition at the Wellcome Collection at guardian.co.uk/video or click the link in our blog.
Science Weekly.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Robin McKee, James Randerson and Ian Sample. Also thanks to our special guest, AC Grayling, whose new programme, Exchanges at the Frontier, begins on the 2nd of December on the BBC World Service. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Search for Science Weekly or for Guardian Science Stories, follow Guardian Science. The podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. And next week, in case you haven't noticed already, it's the very first day of the most important meeting in the world ever. Ever. The UN's Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. We'll break the whole thing down for you with a special international podcast.